Well, thanks for having me, guys. I'm really happy to be part of the System Center community. You know, I've been working with Microsoft 8 years, 4 years as an evangelist, 4 years on the engineering team. And part of my role at Microsoft, I still have the opportunity to continue working with engineering to kind of really understand what was coming next. So what I'm going to be covering here is kind of talking about some of our internal strategy, as well as basically the key sets of features which have been announced today. Now, as Matt mentioned, I've recently moved roles over to Five9 Software, and I'm also working for another company called Scorch Center, building integration packs for System Center Orchestrator. So lots of more fun stuff, hoping to get even more ingrained in the community. Now, we're really going to break this down into kind of three key technical areas: compute, storage, and networking. One thing to keep in mind is that everything we're going to be discussing is public information. I'm not going to be announcing anything new. Everything is based on the technical preview which came out in October. Now, as you kind of think about the engineering cycle, the reason why we focused on these three key areas about what we're covering in this session is because engineering builds them first. When you kind of think about a large, complicated technology like Windows Server, you need to really kind of have that foundation in place before you start building applications or services on top of it. So a lot of what's being released right now is kind of the core infrastructure. A lot of it doesn't even have a graphical user interface, only interacted by PowerShell. But that will gradually come over time. So stay tuned. There's going to be more releases coming out very soon. There's going to be more updates. A lot of big announcements will be coming out around the big conference Ignite in early May. But everything right now, you can touch, you can play with. It's all available in technical preview 1. Now, I suspect a lot of you will have questions. I'm going to be going through about 100 different features in about 50 minutes, so I'm going to be going fast. If you have questions, I can't take them live, but feel free to catch up with me later today. Tweet me. That's my preferred way. That way, when I respond, everybody else can see the same answer as well. Or also feel free to email me if you have a private question. But I do encourage you to tweet so everyone can see it. Add the hashtag SCU2015 so that we can share that with the community. Let's get started with the cloud platform. I'm sure you guys have seen this slide dozens of times from Microsoft now. But really, the key point here is our whole goal about getting consistency for all of our consumers of IT resources. We say three clouds: the Microsoft public cloud, your private cloud, and then these hosters clouds. The reason why we say three clouds is because our whole goal is to allow you to build VMs, applications, and services that run the exact same way, regardless of what cloud they're on. And that's not just, you know, benefiting the IT pros here, right? You build a VM once, it can run on Azure, in someone else's data center, or your data center. But also the developers. They can write applications the same way, with standard APIs. They don't care what cloud it runs on. Your SQL database administrators could build databases on-premise in the cloud. Works the same way. For identity, you have Active Directory that spans both of these clouds as well. Our whole goal here is get that consistent experience. So when you're thinking about building an application or deploying a VM, you don't have to worry about ultimately where it's going to run. It just works. And this consistency has been one of the key engineering tenets for this release: consistency and standardization. Now, the other big tenet with this release was trying to figure out how we get better integration with Azure. And we talk about this as kind of a two-way cycle. A lot of these technologies that are being released in the next version of Windows Server have already been running in Azure for some months, in some cases several years. This means that we're not giving a brand new product to customers that hasn't been tested at enterprise scale. It's been tested in Azure, one of the world's largest clouds, for several years. So hopefully that will speed up adoption. That will give you some comfort that these technologies really are enterprise ready, really are cloud scalable. Now, the other side of this is, within Windows Engineering, every product that gets released has to go through this massive checklist. It's called the Common Engineering Criteria. Now, when I left engineering 4 years ago, it was about 200 pages long. I'm sure it's way bigger now. Tiny checkboxes on every page to make sure that every single Microsoft product is enterprise ready. And so this includes things like making sure it supports Active Directory. Everything can run inside a Hyper-V virtual machine. IP address support, you know, kind of the standard things. But the new big things they've really added: trying to figure out how you can create a hybrid connection with that service, connecting this particular service or application up to a public cloud or a hosting provider to kind of give you that flexibility, that data center without boundaries. So you're going to see a lot of the features here really have a lot of that cross-compatibility, hooking up to Azure so that you can use those resources when you need it. Now, the third big investment that Microsoft's really been looking at is cloud service delivery. This whole concept of self-service. Now, as you think about the kind of traditional definition of a private cloud, we have things like pooled resources. I think we meet that now. We have monitoring. I think we meet that now. And then the other two key tenets are self-service and automation. And so you're going to see a lot more investment around this, trying to provide the best of both worlds so that IT can have stability and that they can deal with businesses' turbulent requirements, new releases, competitive changes, other types of market trends that can ultimately impact the business, which impacts IT. So the whole goal here with the service delivery is create stability, provide self-service for the business so that they can make their requests when they need to, but it doesn't disrupt our IT department too much. Now, we mentioned this consistency. This consistency is what we're really trying to drive into these core storage, network, and compute areas. And what we found is we have these planes that really span compute, storage, and networking. Management, which is kind of what the end user sees, the control plane, which is kind of the brains of the operation, and then the data, the specific service or application. So within compute, when we think about management, we think of the different interfaces you have. You run your applications on a cluster. That's kind of the brains of the operation. And then your VMs are the data. They're consuming the resources. We also have that same model as we think about networking now. Different interfaces. We're going to have a new network controller role in Windows Server. We'll be talking about that shortly. And then our networks themselves is what we use to pass the data. And we think about storage. Different management interfaces. Scale out file server cluster to be the brains of the operation. And then your file servers and storage spaces that contain the data. Now, across these three things, the biggest goal that we try to do here is this standard set of APIs. And these standard APIs are not just interacting with Windows Server now. These are the same APIs that we're using in Azure. So again, another example of that consistency where you can build an application for your on-premise environment, and you can port it to Azure. And it should run the exact same way, same APIs. So we're trying to get this consistency down to the coding level as well. So let's take a look at compute and kind of focus on the key features, key releases here. Now, the three big goals for compute was making sure we're enterprise ready, making sure we have the best platform for all types of applications, and making sure that we're flexible, supporting both Microsoft technologies and Linux. So let's go through some of the key enhancements now coming in Windows Server vNext. These two are some of the most popular ones we got from customers. Being able to dynamically add a networking card or adjust static memory with no downtime for the virtual machine. So your VMs can stay online, they can stay running. Even if you're not using dynamic memory, you're using a fixed static amount, you can now add or remove memory from it. We've also got this with our network adapters as well, giving you the ability to go and add them, go make changes for networking without having to take the VMs offline. We've introduced a concept known as production checkpoints. Now, if you've used checkpoints within Hyper-V in the past, you guys have never done that in production, right? Testing only. No. Everyone uses them in production, but they are risky. The reason why, when you take a checkpoint, what's actually happening is you're capturing all of that in-state memory at that point in time. Now, that's okay if you're doing development, testing, you're not doing production, but there's certain workloads where that's actually not a good idea. Let's say you've got a SQL database inside a VM. You're taking the exact point in time and capturing that, rolling that back. Well, when you go and restore that, it may not come back as you wanted. You may have active connections that got lost, transactions that got lost. And so what we try to do is tell people, don't use this in production, dev and test is okay, but you really need to take a full backup if you're going to go and save something like a SQL database or Active Directory inside a VM, because when you restore it, you need all of that data back. So what we've added in this release is a concept of production checkpoints, fully supported in production now. What actually happens here when you go and say, I want to create a checkpoint, we're actually going to speak to an agent within the virtual machine, a VSS agent, volume shadow copy service, and that's actually going to speak to the specific application within the VM and make sure that you capture a full snapshot. So kind of the same process you would do today if you're creating a backup. This same logic is now built into checkpoints. This way, when we go and capture it, we flush out the file system. We flush out pending transactions. We make sure that we keep track of clients that are connected, disconnected, and their different IP addresses so that when you restore it, you get a complete set of data. So this is going to be a big improvement now, really trying to get that tight integration, allowing you to use these checkpoints in production. Now, Hyper-V Manager itself, we try to add some improvements in as well. First thing is the protocol that we're using to connect to it. We wanted to make that more flexible, so we now moved over to WSMAM. Now, this gives us the ability to use different type of credentials. Now, one advantage of this, if you guys have configured live migration on 2012, 2012 R2, you have to configure delegation between the two hosts that you're doing this copy between, right? There's some additional steps. We can now skip that. By using this CredSSP, we've actually got the credentials saved in our connection, so we can have more flexibility when we turn on live migrations. We can connect to VMs that are running on a host through IP addresses, so giving you more ability to go and test these VMs before they're in production. Broader down-level management support, so Hyper-V Server, Hyper-V Manager, it can support all the way down to 2008 R2. So we're trying to make it the kind of that single point, that single interface to give you that broad management capability. We've also gone and introduced a new format for the virtual machine configuration file. Now, what you have today is you have it in plain text, right? You can go open this configuration file and you see the amount of memory, name of the virtual machines, networks, things like that. Well, we had a problem in the past because people would go and actually edit that text configuration file, save it, and then if that virtual machine moved over to a different host, it actually wouldn't realize a change had been made. So when you move the VM, it wouldn't go and copy those changes over. So we had to go and tell people it's unsupported to manually edit those virtual machine configuration files. People ignored that. They would edit it. They would have a failover or do a live migration, and they would lose track of these changes. So what we've done to protect against that, this is actually now encrypted. So if you go and open the configuration file, it's all in binary format. You can't go and manually edit it. Now, this is a safeguard for not only manual editing, but in some cases, there were some antivirus, some system scanning companies that when they actually scan that configuration file could make changes and cause corruption on it. So we've essentially locked down that configuration file. If you want to go and edit it now, you go use kind of the standard management interfaces, PowerShell, Hyper-V Manager, Failover Cluster Manager, System Center Virtual Machine Manager to kind of protect you from that. We've also added some new architecture around how we do backups. So we're making backups more efficient by introducing a new change block tracking driver. And instead of basically taking an entire backup every time, we just keep track of the blocks that have changed so that we can do incremental backups. This means they're smaller, it means they're faster, and it means that we can get better performance for our entire system. Imagine if you're trying to take 100 VM backups at once. That can really hurt the host. It can overwhelm the host. It can cause bad things like live migrations to get triggered because operations manager might get a pro tip, or VMM might get a dynamic optimization alert. So what we're doing with the incremental changes, trying to do less disruption in the environment, make the backup smaller and easier. So we thought about our best platform for applications. High availability was a key design goal here. So one of the big features that people are excited about is mixed version cluster support, which enables us to do rolling upgrades. So basically, what a rolling upgrade is we have an old failover cluster, and we can serially upgrade each of the nodes one at a time to make it a new failover cluster. We do live migration for the virtual machines so that they don't have downtime as we're upgrading the fabric. Now, there's been some confusion because we kind of had something similar to that in 2012 to 2012 R2. So what's different here? Well, in 2012 to 2012 R2, we allowed you to do a cross-version live migration, but you still needed to have two different clusters. So imagine if I had a 2012 two-node cluster. What I'd have to do is evict one of the nodes, create a brand new cluster, so this had a new cluster name, and then we'd do a live migration between the pair, destroy this one, and add it to the new cluster. So the process required two clusters of two different versions. In this one, we have the exact same cluster, the exact same cluster name. We're just evicting and adding them within that same cluster. So we have mixed versions within a single cluster, within the single name. And this is something that Microsoft's committing to support for all of our technical previews and all of our future releases. So you can gradually roll and upgrade your fabric too. Now the virtual machines themselves, they also have a version number associated with them. This is for compatibility so they know what hosts that particular VM can run on. Now, I personally got in trouble with this last year because I was building all the System Center labs for TechNet, a lot of the hands-on labs you do. I built them on a 2012 R2 host, but my hoster was using 2012. Previously, that was incompatible. If you built on 2012 R2, you can't backport a virtual machine to the previous version. So that was a long, painful process. But what we've done with this release is we're going to support full forwards and backwards compatibility between 2012 R2 and vNext until you hit the switch that says update the version. So this means I can do a forward live migration, a backwards live migration, and keep that dynamic fluid. Once you've got your entire infrastructure updated, then you'll go hit the switch, you'll update the cluster version, you can update the virtual machine version, and then you light up all those features. So it kind of gives you more control when you're ready to make that switch over to vNext. Now, Hyper-V replica is something we introduced in the last release that allows inbox asynchronous replication of Hyper-V virtual hard disks. So we take that hard disk, we go push that to a second location for disaster recovery. So we made a couple improvements around here. First, if you have a virtual machine that you're replicating and you add a new virtual hard disk, we're going to detect that and we're going to start replicating that virtual hard disk for you. We had a lot of customers that they would be having VMs, they would grow their VMs, add new disks, not realize it was being replicated, and that disk would never get copied to the DR site. So we wanted to go integrate that logic here. Secondly, we're going to be introducing more replication settings, so giving you some more granularity on the frequency. Final numbers aren't out yet, but hopefully it'll be very flexible when we finally release this one. Now, we wanted to make some other high availability features too, specifically for clustering. Now, one challenge that we had in today's version of failover clustering is if you have a node that's partitioned, meaning it can't speak to the rest of the nodes in the cluster, and you have virtual machines on it, even if the VMs were healthy and the networks were healthy, we'd actually fail over those virtual machines. There's really no reason to. So what we've done in this release, we fixed that. You can have a node that can't speak to the rest of the cluster. It's isolated. So long as the VMs are healthy, we're going to let them keep running on that. And we made similar improvements with storage as well, being more resilient to temporary storage failures. Instead of crashing a virtual machine, we'll put it in a paused critical state. When the storage gets reconnected, we'll resume that virtual machine. So it basically just gets frozen instead of crashing when it loses its storage connection. Now, we've also had a problem in clustering where we'll find that a particular node may keep crashing multiple times within a certain period. We call this flapping. Now, the challenge of that is if a node's part of a cluster, it goes down and then rejoins. Once it rejoins, things start to fail over. But if it crashes again, they have to fail back. Comes up, fails over. So what we wanted to do is detect this and be more resilient. If we see that the cluster crashes three times in an hour, we're going to put it into a state known as quarantine, where it's part of the cluster, but it's basically a maintenance until the admin can take a look at it. If it stops crashing, we'll automatically take it out of quarantine. But it's kind of like a safeguard to reduce the number of unplanned, unnecessary failovers as well. Now, one of the new big technologies that you guys have probably heard about on the industry are containers. Containers is a technology similar to virtualization, but instead of being able to manage it at the per virtual machine level, we can break it down and manage it through different types of services, different types of applications, front-end, different protocols, back-end. Now, right now, the biggest investment worldwide in containers is around Linux. And so Microsoft, we make sure that we support these Linux containers. We got a partnership with Docker. And a lot of people say, well, do I do virtual machines or do I do containers? Well, reality is, you do both. There's a couple trade-offs you use when you have containers. Now, the big benefit of containers is that we get massive scalability. If you think about if you've got to deploy 10 virtual machines, you've got to use that same operating system on all 10 of them, which may be identical. What we're able to do with containers is use a single operating system and then segment different processes for different users. So that reduces the overall footprint. Now, the downside of containers is you lose the security and isolation that you had with virtual machines because you're sharing address spaces, namespaces, and in some cases, memory. So that could potentially lead to different types of security vulnerabilities if you have a multi-tenant environment. So our best practice around containers is use both. For each of your different tenants, give them a virtual machine so they have that security and isolation. And then within each virtual machine, use containers so that you can break that down and give efficiency for each service or each application. So not only do we support Linux containers, but we've also announced that we're going to be introducing Windows Server containers in vNext. Not much has been announced about this. Not much is known. Stay tuned on this one. This will be an exciting investment. Now, flexibility around Linux has been another key investment, too. A couple years ago, Microsoft hired some of the top open source developers in the world and brought them to Microsoft. And that surprised a lot of people. But what we've really been invested in is better Linux integration throughout the stack, not just Windows Server, all the System Center products as well. So with Linux, we're actually checking code into the core operating system, into the Linux kernel. We check in code that allows Linux virtual machines to better interact with Hyper-V. Things like the integration components are pre-installed. Memory management agents are pre-installed. Now, the benefit of this is when our customers are now downloading and deploying a new Linux distribution, the Linux VM knows that it's part of Hyper-V. It's known as being enlightened. This means that our host can go and manage it. We can get 64 vCPUs, live migration support, backup support, everything like that. So you're going to see us continuing to invest in Linux as a first-class citizen. For management, we've also introduced a concept known as VM groups. VM groups basically allow you to organize a collection of VMs from a management perspective. So maybe you have all of your domain controllers virtualized. I got 3 or 4 domain controllers. Well, I'm going to put them in a group of domain controllers. This way, I can then go and manage them like that, and I can turn on things like anti-affinity so that they purposely get spread out across different hosts. That way, I don't have a single point of failure. If all of my domain controllers are on a single host, that host goes down, I could lose everything. But by putting them in a group, forcing them to spread out, we have higher availability throughout our system. We also introduced some better in-guest management features. So we had a lot of customers that were running inside virtual machines. They needed to do network configuration. They would see several different virtual network adapters, but not really know what was external, what was internal, without doing some advanced configuration, you know, looking for default gateways, things like that. So we've enabled a PowerShell commandlet that will actually identify from within the guest virtual machine the name of the virtual network that each of the interfaces is associated, the name that the host uses. So this kind of gives us some connection there between what the guest is using, what the host management system is using, so that tenants can better identify which network they're being connected to. And then we wanted to go and also improve our updates and allow tenants or people within the guest operating system to be more self-sufficient when they're doing patching. So we're now going to be releasing the updates to the integration services or integration components through Windows Update, Microsoft Update, or the Windows Download Center. Now, previously, the burden of updating the integration services we placed on the host administrator. They can still do that if they want, but now we're giving flexibility so that the tenant, they can also update their integration services when they want. They can patch, they can reboot when they want as well. Now, one of the other big requested features came from wireless connected standby. If you guys have ever done Hyper-V on a Windows 8 Surface, laptop, something like that, you close it up, it goes into this power state known as connected standby, where basically it will allow requests to come in, so if someone sends you a new email, it can receive the email, but it's not really alive and alert. Well, the problem with our last version of Hyper-V, when you try to recover it from connected standby, the networking didn't necessarily work well. So we made some improvements around here, making sure that we have great compatibility with Windows Client, connected standby, laptops. So when people are doing development on client machines or laptops, we're still good there as well. So as you can see, a lot of investments around our core computing capabilities, clustering, and virtualization. So look at networking. Now with networking, the three main goals, flexibility, higher availability and performance, and focusing on the applications and workloads again. So let's see what that really means now. What are the key features? Biggest improvement here is we're now introducing a new role in Windows Server known as the network controller. Brand new role. This network controller is basically going to be the brains of your networking operation. What we realized in our past releases is we had multiple products and tools which kind of managed different subsets. You know, you had IPAM for IP address management, Virtual Machine Manager for virtualized networking. And what we really wanted to try to do is provide a single unified role that would not only manage everything, but also centrally report on everything as well. So this brand new Windows Server role, it's based on what we do up in Azure, so it's been well-tested, well-proven to scale, and it's basically going to be the brains of our physical and virtual networks. So what can it do? Well, it can do network discovery and topology. Here's an example of one of the diagrams that it created, where we've basically done a recursive algorithm from the controller and said, what switches am I connected to? What are they connected to? What are they connected to? So that we can build up this rich topology. Now, this gives us real-time monitoring as well, not within the topology view, within the main management console, but with the real-time monitoring, if we lose network connections, we can detect that, we can report that. Now, the way it does it, it's actually sending very lightweight messages throughout this entire fabric. It has baselines about how fast they should respond, and it checks the round-trip time when it goes and sends these different messages through these different routes. If things deviate too much from the baseline, we'll go raise an alert saying, hey, you have some type of performance problem. So again, really trying to centralize, give you that monitoring and visibility in a single location. We provide automation with this as well. Now, we provide programmatic interfaces, right? WMI, PowerShell, you know, this is kind of the standard things. But with automation, we wanted this to be able to dynamically scale as well. So we've gone and really try to integrate this with every type of automation tool and solution. So when customers need something, it can speak to the controller can automatically go and manage it. We've also gone and introduced a distributed firewall. So essentially, what we're now able to do within the virtual switches on each Hyper-V host, within the port, is program firewall rules. So this means that a host administrator can control what types of services, applications are actually going within each of the individual VMs at that virtual switch level. We also wanted to support not only the protocol which Microsoft supported, network virtualization with generic resource encapsulation, but we are also going to be supporting VMware's software-defined networking protocol as well, VXLAN. Now, this is really important because this is another example of how we're trying to provide interoperability. You know, we know a lot of our customers out there are using VMware and Hyper-V in the same data center. This is becoming more and more common. A lot of the customers, they had VMware for a decade, and now with the benefits of Hyper-V, its new enterprise improvements and its lower cost, people are now doing new deployments on Hyper-V. But they want a way to manage that, and they don't want to have this divide between the two networking stacks. So we wanted to introduce the controller as the brains of both, regardless of which investment in which networking architecture you have, so that we can scale, we can manage, and we can control both networking stacks. Now, when we start to think about networking as well, the other big role that this network controller plays is it's going to allow us to do some NFVs, network function virtualization. This is going to be a term you start to hear more and more from Microsoft and the rest of the industry. An NFV is basically a VM which goes and runs a networking function. So a virtualized load balancer, virtualized switch, virtualized router, virtualized firewall. So what we're now doing with this network controller is providing these different types of resources so that you can easily deploy them. So if I need a new switch, router, load balancer, whatever that is, I can spin that up inside a VM. So I don't need to deploy that physical infrastructure each time. So we've introduced a brand new software load balancer. You guys in the room probably know network load balancing, right? That's been around in Windows for 10 years or something. Hasn't really had any updates in its last couple releases. That's because we've been waiting to introduce this software load balancer. And so this is basically the load balancer that Azure is using. Massive scalability, high performance, multiple load balancing options. This is something that we're now going to be putting directly into Windows Server as well. We have different types of edge gateways, standard ones, making sure that you have protection. The distributed firewall that I talked about earlier, that comes through here as well. Now, the network controller can also provide what we call service chaining. Service chaining basically allows you to create the flow of network traffic so that it goes from one location to another through different types of services, applications, or virtual machines that you need for protection. So let's say, for example, you have a client that's connecting over the public internet. Well, maybe we first want to take him through our VPN server, then we want to take him through another firewall, then we need to log in through some other type of credentials, then we go route him through different load balancers. What we're able to do with this concept of service chaining is take all of these individual components and virtual machines and force the traffic to be routed between them so that we guarantee that this particular user goes through the different type of security or access points that we want them to. We want to make sure, of course, we support Linux virtual machines, And I got to throw in our little Azure Express route, being able to go and connect this up to Microsoft Azure for fast throughput. Now, with even faster and higher performance, also based in our control plane on Azure here, we got our standardized APIs we mentioned earlier, continuing to support the Hyper-V extensible switch so that you can send traffic in and out of the switch, do things such as filtering, scanning, antivirus, firewall through that switch, and continuing to support RDMA, remote direct memory access, for our networking cards so that you get faster throughput when you have a virtual machine connecting to a physical NIC. Let's move on and talk about storage. Now, big goals here, again, working towards this model of software-defined storage, right? Reducing costs, better efficiency, and connecting to the cloud. So big investment areas. First, that key focus on software-defined storage. So there's been a lot of performance improvements that have been made to things like storage spaces, trying to make it more efficient. Improvements to SMB 3.0. So if you've got virtual machines that are stored in a file share, making sure that we can access that data faster. And we still support deduplication, storage tiering, some other performances around there. But we've had these around since our last release. What's new? Well, first of all, within a cluster, we can now put our file share witness up in Azure. So what is a file share witness and how does this reduce cost? Well, today, if you have a multi-site cluster, which means that you have some nodes on one location, other nodes in a different data center, one challenge that we had was when you had a partition between the two sites, which site should stay up, which site should go offline? You don't want two simultaneous sites running the same workload, writing the same application data, because when they get merged, we're going to have corruption. So the way to solve this scenario here was to have a vote within the cluster's quorum model at a third site. So this got expensive, right? Most customers only have one data center. Maybe two if they're lucky. Rarely do they have three where they can just have an extra disk that can do voting or a file share. So in many cases, they would go rent a virtual machine from a hoster, set everything up, and have that vote just run in someone else's data center. So that was expensive, that was complex. So we now support adding this vote directly into Microsoft Azure. So you have your two votes in one site, two votes in another, and then this other arbitrating vote up in Azure. Try to make things even easier, better integration. Now, this is probably going to be one of the biggest features coming out in our next release. DAS-only clusters. We are removing entirely the dependency on shared storage within a failover cluster. That is huge. Now, if you kind of think of the history of clustering, right? Originally, we had this hard dependency on a SAN, right? Those are expensive. Fiber channel, iSCSI, serial attached SCSI, fiber channel over Ethernet, right? Those were the options clustering used to have. But that was a physical hardware investment. Now, in 2012 R2, we made things more flexible. You can now run your Hyper-V virtual machines over a file share. If you kind of think about what an SMB file share is, it's an access point that can be connected to through multiple locations. So node 1 can access whack-whack my share. Node 2 can access whack-whack my share. So that's kind of a cheaper way to do shared storage. Now, with this release, we're going even cheaper, getting rid of that requirement for shared storage entirely. Now, what we can do with this this type of configuration here with DAS-only clusters is we use that disk that the cluster physically owns, that's physically attached to that individual node. Now, what's happening behind the scenes here is we're taking advantage of storage spaces. So storage spaces is kind of the software-defined storage where you can go and create a pool of disks. And one of the features of storage spaces is replication. And so what we've basically done here is we go and set up a three-way mirror where data that gets written to my node that's running the application immediately syncs and replicates to data on two other nodes in the cluster. So we've basically used an existing inbox replication technique with mirroring to ensure that all of our data is available on three nodes in a cluster at any point in time. So if I lose a primary and a secondary, hopefully we still got that at least a third location. So again, no requirement for any shared storage with clusters in the next release. Now, I will say there's likely going to be limitations around it, maybe the number of nodes, maybe the scales, maybe the workloads. That's still being figured out, but this is a key investment and certainly something we want to support with Hyper-V. Now, improving storage efficiency was something we worked on as well. We've had storage quality of service for a while now. Quality of service basically allows you to assign maximums or minimums to different types of traffic, like network or storage traffic, so that you can make sure that an individual virtual machine doesn't take up all of the storage traffic, or that an individual virtual machine gets guaranteed a minimum amount of storage traffic. So we've continued to improve this, make it more flexible. So here you can see in the screenshots, we've set a maximum. We've also set a fixed amount as well, a new application where we basically said that the maximum equals the minimum. And so this is kind of given as a fixed static amount of disk I/O as well. We do normalization so that we can actually send alerts if something gets triggered that's kind of unconventional, if you have a disk storm. And we can also measure this at the per virtual machine or the per virtual hard disk level. We improved shared virtual hard disks as well. So for some context, what's a shared VHDX? Well, basically, if you have two virtual machines and you want to go create a guest cluster, which is a fully virtualized failover cluster, we still need shared storage. And so what we're able to do is we can actually provide a virtual hard disk as that shared storage. So if I have a virtualized SQL VM and another virtualized SQL VM, they need that single shared database, right, for consistency. Well, we put that on a virtual hard disk instead of having to put it on a LUN. And so what that meant for hosters, they really liked that because we had these guys managing the fabric and they didn't want to have to expose that underlying hardware to their tenants, right, and actually assign an individual LUN to every guest cluster. So what they're able to do is create one massive LUN for all the guest clusters or multiple LUNs, and within that one big LUN, create lots of little virtual hard disks so that each tenant, they could manage it at the virtual hard disk level. So kind of a level of abstraction here. So shared VHDX, they're growing in use, but we wanted to make some improvements in this release. First, they now support replica. So you can replicate that virtual shared VHD, making sure that you have disaster recovery. We could go resize that dynamically, grow it and shrink it. And we have better integration with backup, so we make sure that we capture all the data. So just trying to make that shared VHDX a first-class citizen, really complete the journey with that feature. With cluster shared volumes, which is the distributed access system for Hyper-V, runs on a cluster, a couple of improvements were made around performance. And we can also do improvements with CSV caching. So CSV caching, similar to RAM caching, something like that, we're basically looking at types of disk read and write that happen frequently on a cluster shared volume disk. Keep a local cache on the individual host for faster access. So we made a lot of performance improvements around that so that your cluster shared volume disk interact with the virtual machines faster. We also support online check disk now. So if you feel that you have some inconsistency with the disk, some corruption, we can actually go and scan that disk, run check disk against it with no downtime. We don't actually have to take it offline. Now, if you need to go fix it, you will actually have to do some downtime then. But at least the initial scanning, the initial diagnosis, no downtime. We also wanted to go and improve our high availability story for disaster recovery as well. This is going to be one of the other biggest features coming out in this release, inbox storage replication. So this is providing not just asynchronous like Hyper-V replica, this also provides inbox synchronous replication too. So what this means is I can literally create two volumes. They don't have to be the same size. They can be different locations, different file systems, different arrays. We don't care, very flexible. And we can replicate data between them at the block level. And that's why we don't care about what the file system is. We're replicating at the block level. So this gives you a completely free inbox disaster recovery solution. And again, I want to emphasize this can now do synchronous replication, which means that if I have two sites, any change happening at site A happens at site B as well, and an acknowledgement sent back before we commit the transaction. So this guarantees us consistency at both sites. What we were doing before with Hyper-V replica is it was asynchronous replication, which meant that a change would happen at one site, and another change, and another change, and every 5 minutes we would push those changes across. So if you had a crash before that 5 minute replication point happened, you could lose data. So we got past that. We now have full synchronous, full asynchronous replication in the box. Now, we also improved integration with backup across all of our different backup products. If you really want to go details of these, there's a great session at TechEd Europe that was released all about Hyper-V backup, Windows Server backup. And they go into a lot more details around the change block tracking drivers, other different ways they've gone and implemented this. And what about everything else? You know, I focused on these three key workloads here, compute, network, storage, but there's more coming inside Windows Server too. So some of the other Windows servers and roles, what are the key features here? Now, Active Directory, as far as the core product goes, limited improvements have been made here. And that's because a lot of the investment is actually being made in Azure Active Directory. That's where the engineering team is being focused on. With Azure Active Directory, this is kind of what Microsoft envisions the future to be. Because by having Active Directory in a public cloud, we've immediately fixed a lot of problems that customers have about having multiple sites. How do they go and span them? How do they create these different forests, these different domains, and these different trust relationships? By taking advantage of putting Azure in the cloud, we immediately fix a lot of those problems about that different site, different communication, different authentication. So a lot of investment being made up in Azure Active Directory. The other feature that's been released in the technical preview one is that Active Directory Federated Services can now authenticate against other different identity data stores. So previously, ADFS had to use Active Directory, but now it can authenticate if you have user credentials in a SQL database or in another lightweight database like LDAP. Windows Defender, which is the inbox anti-malware solution, that's now being turned on by default inside Windows Server vNext. But there's no GUI. So it still actually doesn't really interfere with the end user. They kind of don't ever really see it. It's running in the background for them. They'll get alerted if there's a problem. But as far as day-to-day management goes, it's hidden. They don't care. But we still have APIs so that we can centrally report on that from a centralized management server. DNS. Been some improvements around server logging, so you get more details about different types of attempts, better historical evidence, so you can actually go and backtrack if there's been different types of security attacks. You can now change the policy that the server responds to for different DNS queries. So based on the user's IP address, based on other information that they send in that request, we actually have policies and logic that can go send them to different sites or different locations. We have better IPAM integration, the IP address management system. So we now get a historical view of different IP addresses that a particular service or application has connected to or used over time. And then multi-client binding. So if you have a client machine, you know, a server, real client machine, that has multiple network connections, we can actually assign different policies and bind different policies to the different network adapters. So let's say you have a very fast network adapter you want to use to access SQL. We could assign that policy to that DNS record so that that network adapter gets hooked up to the correct path, to the correct database. We've also introduced another role inside Windows Server, the multipoint services role. And this actually came from another Microsoft Server technology known as multipoint server. Basically, multipoint server allows groups of people to go and interact on the same server at the same time. So this is often used for children at school, help desk scenarios, kind of thin client scenarios where you have multiple users accessing a single server with the same username, user account. So this is now available inside Windows Server. So multiple people can log on and go and interact with the server. We're really not sure kind of the end scenarios that this is going to expose. Very new. Right now, you can really just kind of turn the server on and log in. So end functionality, we're still kind of waiting on that. Remote desktop services. We've improved compatibility with RemoteFX, supporting new protocols. So if you have new types of drivers, new types of graphics, interactions you need, we're trying to support the latest and greatest. And then the web application proxy, which allows us to take connections, forward them around. There's several different new publishing options available so that you can go and produce different types of information, allow people to visualize it, and go and get different rules and forward it. PowerShell's had a lot of improvement as well. As Microsoft's kind of a centralized authoritative management solution, we've been putting a lot of investment in here. Now, I'd actually, if you're really into PowerShell, I encourage you to go to the TechNet article on technical preview. It's about 20 pages long, talking in detail about all of the different PowerShell improvements, you know, down to the individual commandlets. But I just wanted to highlight a couple big ones here. All the PowerShell capabilities for V5, that's now installed by default. We now have the ability to actually go and create a class in PowerShell. So for those that aren't developers, no developer background, basically a class is where you can go and define a set of attributes or a set of functions that can be called multiple times. we can actually now build that in PowerShell. So PowerShell's kind of making it a little more developer-friendly, giving a little more flexibility in how you manage that. There's new modules built into it for zipping files. We also have the ability with a new module to go and download internet packets. So if you want to go run a script where you actually need to go and install something and update it, that's now fully integrated with a new module. We're also integrated with the PowerShell Resource Gallery, which is a community and Microsoft-driven gallery or collection of different scripts, different objects. And so you can call that gallery directly, download different resources. Or if you go run a new script on a new computer, it could speak to the gallery, it could use the download package, install the different modules it needs, and then kind of continue running the script. So it gives you more availability, more flexibility as you're running scripts on different systems. And then improvements around eventing, new encryption options, new debugging options as well. But probably the biggest investment has been around desired state configuration, DSC. Basically what desired state configuration does is it allows us to go and point to a node, let's say a server, and then compare different properties on that server to a file that defines how it should look. So for example, all of my servers I might want to be running as Windows Server Core. If I go and scan my environment and say, compare them to this configuration file that says it should be running Windows Server Core, it could go and report back to me any that are misconfigured, any that have drifted away from that. You know, I have an administrator, he's really bad at PowerShell, he turned on the full shell so he could do the GUI, forgot to turn it off. Now, the other thing about DSC, desired state configuration, is for many of these different services, if we notice that there's a configuration drift, we can automatically fix it as well by invoking other scripts, other commands. So I can basically define my perfect environment, define my perfect domain controller, DNS server, file server, Hyper-V host. Always constantly be scanning my environment and being able to understand when things change and know how to fix them as well. Some of the improvements made in this release was actually throttling the number of simultaneous connections. Because in some cases, if you were comparing every virtual machine, that could go and start a DSC storm, where we'd be literally running tasks comparing thousands of VMs across the data center at once. So we now have the ability to throttle that and limit it to a specific number of connections. We have more centralized logins, so we can actually write all the reports from all of the servers now in a single location. So as an administrator, easy to view, easy to understand everything. Also, synchronization around multiple computers. And we've also got a new feature that allows a partial configuration in a document. So this was that file that basically defined these different parameters. In our older version of DSC, you often had to have every single parameter filled out for it to be accepted. We now allow partial parameters, partial files, and we can kind of just take those different pieces, combine them, so we can still support desired state configuration. So as I wrap that up, hopefully you can see we've really been trying to put a lot of investment in this, really focusing on the technical preview one for that core functionality with the compute, with the storage, with the networking. But as you can start to see, high availability, supporting these mission-critical applications, that's been a key investment area. Make sure that we're really kind of moving to a model, instead of just high availability, continual availability. Trying to go from 99% of uptime to 100% uptime. So a lot of investments here. Other big investment you've noticed here, the software-defined data center, right? Seeing how not only are we virtualizing our servers with VMs, but now virtualizing the networking fabric, virtualizing the storage fabric, and then simplifying that management, making sure that we can have these single locations, these endpoints, and when we need to, go and connect them up to Azure. Now, hopefully I gave you a broad overview. I'm sure you guys have a lot of questions, and I'm sure there's a lot I cannot answer yet. But in any case, please tweet me, send me an email if you want, #SCU2015, and we'll try to get through those. Here's some other resources that I recommend if you're looking to learn more about Server vNext. Microsoft Virtual Academy, the free Microsoft online training portal. We're actively working on courses for vNext. Just a couple weeks ago, we released one on business continuity, so take a look at some of the different backup and high availability options. We have free eBooks available on the MVA. And to actually get the technical preview, you can download the eval. We've got documentation on TechNet that walks through all the different features. And very, very soon in the next, hopefully, 2 or 3 weeks, we'll actually have hands-on labs on technical preview as well on TechNet vLabs. So great opportunity to take a photo, not just of me, but of the screen. Guys, go over there. And with that, I do want to thank all of you for coming to System Center Universe, all of you that are watching online. Thanks for joining as well. And don't forget, you can see all of these recordings on Channel 9 after the event. Thank you.